Good morning. I'm calling to order this meeting of the House Workforce Labor and Economic Development Finance and Policy Committee. It is March 26th, and welcome to all. We have a quorum. We're going to start with our minutes. And Chair Baker, are you willing to move approval of the minutes?
Happy to do so, Mr. Chair, from the minutes from March 25th, 2026, as presented.
Thank you, sir. Any additions or corrections, members? I'm not seeing any. All in favor of approval of the March 25th minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay. At least the chairs are voting on that one. I think we maybe had backup from others. So, members, we have got a presentation that we had directed, a report that we directed Deed to do last year, and we're going to get a presentation on that and then consider a couple bills. We're going to start with that presentation, and so I'll call up, I believe, Mr. Bowdery. We've got a whole crowd up there. Excellent, sir, and commissioners. Well, so, yeah, why don't you make your way on up, our friends from Deed, and we'll start with that. And then we're going to have two bills that will consider some competitive grants for us to think about, and then another bill as well. So members of the public, there's materials about this presentations on your on the website, and of course that's in our packet as well. So Commissioner, I don't know if you're going to start. Whoever is going to, please identify yourself and welcome.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Matt Verlich. I serve as Commissioner of the Department of Employment and Economic Development. And I'm joined, as you can see, by Mike Lang on my left, Director of Workforce Strategies and Innovation, as well as our Director of Government Relations, Devin Bowdery, on my right.
Excellent. Good. So glad to have you. So, yeah, please dive in.
Great. Thank you. So, as you can see, we are covering today the review of workforce development programs and competitive grant process preliminary report. There will be a further report in 2027 as well. Here, just an overview. I think we have about 10 slides or so, an overview of what we'll cover, the legislative background for this report that we've done, the Workforce Development Division Competitive Grant Program principles, and an overview of the life cycle, all the steps that we follow in the course of doing a large number of competitive grants. And so first, the legislative background and sort of the why we are in the midst of this work with the report. You can see the source of the legislation, and in fact, that is the same law that created the Workforce Task Force that you and Co-Chair Baker are members of, and I believe he is the co-chair of that, where we've had lots of great conversations and discussions that I think has been sort of illuminating for all, and then this report is a complementary piece to it that, again, walks you through in more detail all the steps that we follow. And as you can see there at the bottom, it indicates preliminary report due in 2026 and a final report in 2027. And speaking of due dates, I will just acknowledge that we were overdue on the delivery of the timing of this one, so my apologies for that. Next to the principles that we follow in the course of doing our various competitive grants, and you know, we're focused in this report on workforce development programs, but I think this largely would be true for the full range of competitive grants that we do at the agency. Number one, accountability and oversight. And you can see the subpoint there is that we have developed a financial oversight system for grants intended to protect public funds from waste, fraud, and abuse. And it says we've developed, but of course we also follow the rules as created by the Office of Grants Management at Department of Administration. Next principle is accessibility of information. We have over time try to simplify our application materials, translate key documents, and expanded outreach efforts to remove barriers to application. And one thing I'd like to emphasize there, number one, there will always be organizations that have not yet heard of what we have available at Deed and who may not yet have found our website where we list all the grants that are available to us, but many, many have, and that is why we typically get many multiples of applicants seeking, let's say, $8 million if we have $2 million available. So even though there are some who haven't found us yet, many, many have and are able to go through the process and make those applications. It's just that there is so much demand, we are typically very much oversubscribed. And then the third principle, empowerment through community voice. We have a robust community reviewer process to involve non-Deed experts in the review and recommendation process to make sure that even though we think we're smart and we know things about what communities need, we know that we don't know it all, and we want to also be informed by what other experts across the state of Minnesota can bring to bear in terms of identifying the best applications. So next, an overview of the steps that we follow in the grant lifecycle. And this, I mean, it's very, I think, intuitive when you walk through what all is here. First, the legislature passes a law with signature of the governor to create a program, and then DEED develops guidelines, processes, and materials related to within the guide rails and boundaries of what is established in the law. We announce requests for proposal publicly, and then the application period opens up. We promote the program widely through emails and on the website, through public events, et cetera, providing education materials to potential applicants. Then the application period closes, applications are reviewed, and awardees are recommended. Ultimately, at the department, I get to see all of the recommendations for who would receive grants, and then I get to approve those. The awards are announced and grant contracts are signed. Unsuccessful applicants, as you can see, get feedback if they want it about their applications. And then finally, grantees implement their programs with monitoring and oversight from our staff. And then ultimately we close out the grant. And the cycle begins again. Next, on to risk assessment and conflict of interest. We follow the requirements as outlined in Minnesota Statute 16B and as defined by OGM, as we referred to earlier, and further in DEED policies. We conduct pre-award risk assessments on grants of $50,000 or more prior to entering into contracts. Again, part of the process of ensuring integrity of our process. And then again, we follow OGM and internal policies on handling individual and organizational conflicts of interest. Something that we also, of course, have to ask about when it comes to those community reviewers, because we want their expertise, but we have to be sure that, you know, they wouldn't attempt to use their day job, so to speak, to improperly influence our process. So payments are primarily done on a reimbursement basis, meaning that the recipient of the grant does the work, submits the receipts, and only then, once we can match up the receipts for work completed to what was in the budget and the eligible uses of the grant, only then do we reimburse them for those allowable costs. We do have the flexibility, though, in rare instances to do advance payments, and they can request that through a particular form based on financial need, cash flow need, et cetera, and again, only if we have confidence in the financial management capabilities of the organization. And our internal audit team makes a recommendation on those requests for approval or rejection. Monitoring while the work is underway, we ensure compliance with the contract and provide support to grantees. And again, that reflects that balance that we're trying to strike of making sure that the dollars are spent as required and also assisting to make sure that the nonprofit grant recipient can make the most of that grant opportunity by delivering services to Minnesotans. So the monitoring support extends throughout the duration of the grant. Fraud prevention measures, you can see, include random audits, eligibility checks, and documentation reviews. We do a financial reconciliation of the expenditures at least once before the last payment. And then when we identify an organization as high risk, a monitoring visit is conducted within the first two quarters of the grant agreement. And high risk could just be an organization that's relatively new to our process, for example. And then for grant closeout, at the end of the grant period, we submit final reports of financial documentation. We verify that all the funds were used appropriately. The grant is formally then closed out in the state's financial system. And then we do post-award debriefs to gather feedback to improve future processes. And we certainly take into consideration the performance of any given nonprofit when we are evaluating future applications for other funds. Community collaboration. We say in the first bullet that the Workforce Development Division regularly does engages with workforce development organizations and community members for feedback. And in the report, which some of you may have already had a chance to look at, I would note, too, that we collaborate also with DEED's Office of Public Engagement that just is well practiced in convening groups of Minnesotans to get their insights on various topics. because, you know, one of the critiques that we've heard in the past is that people don't know about our programs, they don't know how to get in contact with us, they find the stuff confusing, et cetera. And so we're always trying to have our ears open and make adjustments for how we can address those critiques, again, while protecting the integrity of the process and protecting the fact that the dollars are used for the required purposes according to the law. So we did a series of listening sessions from 2023 to 2025 that revealed several insights, including requests to simplify language, feedback on the administrative processes. And by the way, you know, this is something that I would also get lots of context from members of the legislature urging us to speed up the process, get the money out the door. But then we also get urging to not speed up the process and, you know, don't cut any corners in a way that would put dollars at risk. And so it's just a balancing act that we're always trying to strike. We also get requests for additional technical assistance. And so we do webinars and other workshops as well to try to make it all as transparent as possible and to a certain extent upgrade the capacity of organizations to apply effectively. And then we've also heard a desire for additional outreach to greater Minnesota and to non-English speaking communities. And I'll just note again, as a resident of greater Minnesota, this one is personal to me. I think this is our last slide, followed by the question slide, just in terms of next steps from our perspective to support comprehensive review of our competitive grant programs. We remain engaged in that engagement process with stakeholders, and that will help to ensure representation across the workforce development sector, geographic representation and across demographic groups, and the findings from that ongoing process will be included in the final report, and you can see some of the questions there at the bottom that we are still seeking input on. And with that, it concludes my presentation of the report, and we'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you so much, Commissioner. Thanks for the presentation and for the work. I'll see if anybody has anything they want to start with. I have a number of questions, but the first thing, I would just want to put this in context for our committee members, members of the public as well, that Chair Baker and I had specifically, I think we initiated this, and then Chair Champion agreed as well, and the three chairs thought that it made a lot of sense for us to examine just how the competitive grant processes work and how they can work better. So I'm really glad to get this preliminary report, and those key questions seem really exciting to get answered for us to be able to move the process forward as well. So I'll just sort of jump in, and again, if any members, please, if you have anything, Chair Baker, we'll start with you. Yeah.
If you want to go first, I don't
know. Yeah, I've got a few things. So actually, no, maybe I'll just ask one thing, which is the gentleman sitting to your left, Commissioner, you identified as Mike Hale, I believe, Mr. Hale. I was just wondering if you could identify yourself, and I'd like to know more about the office that you lead, because I don't know that I had been so aware of it before, and it was an intriguing title, and I feel like it could be useful. So if you could just describe the work that you do.
Yes, so I am running.
I need to have you identify yourself if you can.
My apologies. Yeah. My name is Mike Lang. I am the director of workforce.
Mike Lang, I'm sorry, Mr. Lang. I don't know why I had that.
That's right.
Up. Mr. Lang, please.
But as the director of workforce strategies and innovation, I am in a position across the different divisions in our workforce development division to do work that crosses along all areas. And so this falling into that realm of work, because of the various ways that we do grant processes. But in this role, I also support in a variety of ways, like helping with some financial oversight and helping with the program areas. I can fill in different areas where there may be some special projects needed. And so I have filled a variety of roles to do that, as well as strategic planning towards proactive improvement of all of our processes and work. Okay. I have 27 years with in that the Workforce Development Division work too, so it made me well suited to advise and assist.
Okay, thank you. Good, yeah, good to know. Thank you, Mr. Lang. Chair Baker, to you.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, and welcome to the committee, folks from DEED. I think what I know that we worked on a lot last year with my co-chair and in the whole committee was to better understand some of the outcomes of our competitive grants and direct appropriations. And I think we heard with the OLA report last year that we really didn't do a great job understanding if a program, you know, that had gone through the process and the grant was closed out, were they successful or not? And I think that's the part that I'm trying to get to is, did we find out if there were some nonprofits or folks that went through the process and say trained a bunch of people out of incarceration or whatever that their focus was, we weren't able to really determine, at least with the OLA report, we weren't able to determine if that was successful or not. What did participation mean and what did graduation mean? Or what did sort of, did they increase their career steps or did they not? Do you have any suggestions for us? And or maybe are you making some internal changes about what can we do then to make sure that when we are putting out taxpayer dollars to this, that we need to show folks are actually moving up the chain. They're taking good advantage of this to a degree and a percentage that we can kind of accept. Is there any thoughts about the OLA report last year and how we can get better documented outcomes? Commissioner or anybody?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the question. And first, I would just note about my colleague, Mike, too, as you heard, with 27 years of experience, he's been a great utility player with deep experience in career force, also in the grants process, and you might have heard our acronym ETP, Employment and Training Programs, and that tends to be our primary grant-making entity on the workforce development side, and then other roles as well with respect to strategic planning, et cetera. And so, Mike, I would, in fact, invite you to weigh in on this in a sec as well if you have further thoughts on this. And Co-Chair Baker, you'll recall in the Workforce Task Force, we did have some discussion, including with the OLA staff present on this topic. And it's, in fact, I would need to go back and remind myself a little bit of the nuance of what they were saying, because we certainly have goals beforehand for any given program, as well as at the individual grantee level, where they tell us, okay, we are applying for $200,000, and with that amount of money, we think we can serve X number of people with the following kinds of services, and then we hope that that will either yield a credential or somehow higher earning capacity, et cetera. And then in the course of monitoring and closeout, we also do get an after-action analysis from them of how many did we actually enroll, and if the numbers are vastly lower than we expected, of course, we would take that into account. And so, I mean, we can aggregate those numbers then and say, actually, yes, here are the total number of people we served. And again, in aggregate, we can also say they made this wage beforehand, and now they make this wage. Now, disentangling whether it was the program that caused the change in wage is a little tricky. I guess it sort of comes down to what we define as success. But we are equipped to tell you how many we served and you know, to a large degree, what they were able to do afterward. But, you know, what additional kinds of goals and metrics within that? I know we are having conversations and including across multiple agencies to see if there are common metrics that we can use even to help kind of lead to a more systematic process within the administration of making the case for this program at this agency versus this program at this agency so that we can confidently tell you we are recommending the highest impact stuff. But it's not that we're starting from scratch in terms of those metrics and goals. Mike, what would you add to that?
Mr. Lang.
Thank you, Commissioner, and thank you, Mr. Chair. I would add that we have also in the recent months been conducting some listening sessions with some of the organizations that actually provide some of these services. We worked with an organization called WorkWell, with a group of workforce organizations, as well as our Minnesota Association of Workforce Boards, to engage on that idea and come up with some common outcomes and ways to measure that don't necessarily fit some of the federal reporting guidelines, which a lot of our reporting is based on. And so we are in the process of doing that. We recently did a group recently did a presentation on some proposed ideas, and we are looking to refine those into some recommendations on different ways of tracking that can cross different kinds of programs.
Chair Baker.
Thank you. And I know that some organizations do a little bit of a different model, and that might be sort of a paper for performance, where they actually get paid on people that actually graduate and find work. Again, there's not a lot of them that do that, but some that do are very successful with that. Again, when we get participants, and again, when, as the commissioner stated, we get folks that have, they say they're going to hit 300 participants. The participants may not be there at the end of the program. There might be, out of 300, there might be 75 left. Whatever that may or may not be, I'm just using hypothetical here. My point is, I'd rather get into, let's make sure we even pay those organizations better per participant that's graduating, so that we know they actually have gotten through that process. A lot of these participants have a great future ahead of them, but sometimes they fall off for many different reasons. And I wonder if we can start looking at, as a body, to start rewarding better that way, to get those early folks that want to participate. They might need a couple extra hands to pull them along, and that might take a little bit more money or resources from that organization helping them. Again, I don't have the answer. We're trying to get deeper into how can we use taxpayer dollars to help people grow their careers so they're more productive for themselves and their family, but also for our society. So I just know that this is an important area that we need to talk about. And again, I'm challenged to think of the participants that they come to us and say, or to you, and they say, we're going to hit 300 people for this industry or this discipline, and what we actually graduate is much, much less, and that is my concern. So I just want to just share that with the body. That's all. So thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Chair Baker. Can you flip back a slide? Mr. Brad, I don't know if you're running this.
Mr. Chair, I've got it. Yep.
Okay, good. Yeah. Well, just to build on Chair Baker's points, I guess I might encourage you, because I too was going to bring up the idea of metrics, I guess was the term that I was going to use, and recognizing it really is complicated in this area. And first, not to say that you don't have metrics you're operating off of, Commissioner, you described that. And also not to say that it's something that's simple. People enter, if you're talking about workforce development programs, they sort of enter at different stages. And having said that, it does seem like a key question to answer is sort of, are the metrics that we're using the best metrics we can? What are best practices, et cetera? And so I might encourage you in your, I've got a few other key questions I would add, but that would be at least one of them, building on what Chair Baker had to say. I'll go to Representative Zeleznikar, I guess, next. Representative Zeleznikar.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you. I just had a couple questions. On the page, you're talking about monitoring. And you talked about fraud measures include random audits. I'm just curious if you could walk me through how you determine that. Is it by the amount of the grant, or if they're a new idea, or if you could just explain that?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you. I would say at a high level, and then I'll look to Mike again, at a high level, if an entity is determined in the pre-award risk assessment to be in the high-risk category, they're going to get more attention. Beyond that, how we select for random, using that term, I'm not quite sure.
Mr. Lang.
Representative, Mr. Chair, there may be some different guidance that would select different organizations that might be more in the realm of needing to have some additional monitoring, maybe through different questions or experiences that they're having. So at some point, it may be sort of a directed additional monitoring. But as far as selection, I'd have to look into that a little bit more and get back to you on how the random process works.
Representative Zeleznikar.
Chair Pinto, thank you, and thank you for that response. That would be great. I just was curious. And the second question is to Chair Baker's point on just the outcomes and grant success. I've been really excited in Two Harbors because we've done some really targeted things. And when we did that grant, and Deed has done a great job, we got the EMT rolled out in 6 months after session end. But I can tell you how many graduates we have, and they're actually on the North Shore, so we have ambulance services covered. So the whole goal was, what's the strategic plan? how many kids can we get educated with no cost on that EMT partnering with high school, and it was a collaborative way, and the outcomes are showing. So it was the goal, and then the outcomes there. We actually graduated students. We solved a problem. Ambulances will be staffed. And the second issue was critical access hospitals with the CNAs. It was the same thing. When the hospital CEO is working a shift as an aide, we have a problem. And so how we'll know if we have graduated CNAs and we have six or seven that enrolled in February and they're shadowing med-surg nurses so they can get real-life experience and they're training at the hospital, so they're building relationships. And then when they're past the test and they're actually working at the hospital or the nursing home and staying in that community, we will see the success. And so I would urge you to have metrics that show some of those things, because we're doing exactly that on a small scale. The CNA thing was like $40,000, but it's meaningful when you actually solve the problem. So any data like that would be very helpful for this committee. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Representative Lesnikar. And then Commissioner, if you can go back to, in the slides, back to the one that says, listen to your principles, and I'll just have a series of questions about a couple slides. And on this one, I just want to ask about the note about the community voice and the community reviewer process. And maybe this is as much to just, are you examining as part of this review process how well those community voices are being involved and sort of how that could be improved, if at all? Because I know you have that process. You know, one of the things that we do here is a concern that as we're running competitive grants through the agency, that the agency is maybe not as connected to community needs. So we hear that a lot. Is that something that you're examining as part of this process, or can you examine that about how to do an even better job to make sure to incorporate community voices, Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, thanks. I guess just to elaborate a little bit on how it currently works is that we recruit these community reviewers, and then out of, let's say, 100 applications, we would ask each of them not to look at all 100, but rather a slice of, let's say, 10 or so, and then their recommendations are aggregated together with the other recommendations, and then I will get a ranking that says, okay, we recommend ultimately these top 20 scoring entities, and those 80 that fall below the line of the dollars available will not be approved. And so theirs is one voice among many. And then we also do reserve the right, though, to not simply rubber stamp what the points yield, but rather to look then at sort of a systematic level, and I think this is part of my responsibility, to say, okay, even if all the highest scoring entities happen to fall in, you know, Northeast Minnesota or wherever it might be, well, we need to have some geographic distribution. We need to maybe make sure that we're not all concentrated in one industry, if it's the Drive for Five, for example. And so we reserve the right to make a few moves there so that we have sort of a good portfolio approach of the ultimate winners of the grants. In terms of significant changes to the community reviewer process, I'm not aware that we have anything major cooking there. Mike, anything you would add on that?
Yeah. I guess, though, I think my question was sort of, maybe just to step back. My thinking, for my part at least, I won't speak for the other two chairs, but my thinking in this is to say, like, to examine very carefully our competitive grant processes across the agency and say, what, if anything, can be done to improve them, evaluate how well they're working now. And it may be that there's nothing to change or improve, but we want to make sure to examine all of it. So I guess there may be nothing cooking in that area, but I guess are you examining that from every angle and saying, is there anything to improve? And then maybe you choose and say, no, there is nothing to improve. But that, I guess I'll just say, that feels like a particular sticking point for me, is the ability of our grant processes to really reflect community needs. So I guess if there's nothing cooking now, I'd encourage you to be looking at that more. Mr. Bowdery, you've got something to add.
And Mr. Chairman, I would just say, I would not ever make the claim that there's really nothing to improve. So our ears are always open. Devin, what would you add there?
Mr. Chair, members, Devin Bowdery, Government Relations Director. So for our community reviewers, the goal is for each review panel to be made up of at least 25% community reviewers. A lot of the review panels hit closer to 50%. And when we solicit community reviewers to participate, those email blasts go out and the same channels that our RFPs do. We work with the ethnic councils to distribute those, our own gov delivery lists. I think we can always do more on outreach and casting a wider net to recruit, but.
Yeah, I mean, I guess where I'm coming from in this is if we hear one concern about the department distributing funds and awarding grants is that the department does not know community needs as well as other organizations do. I guess I'm wondering, you know, what your response to that would be. I think you'd say like, hey, we think we're doing a very good job of incorporating those needs. But then I guess I'd want to make sure that criticism is being examined and we're making sure to understand those needs as best as we can, if you understand my point. So, Commissioner, please.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we would agree with the statement that we don't fully understand community needs, and so that is why we try to have the ears open. That is why we have the Office of Public Engagement to seek that insight and using those community reviewers. In some instances, we also use intermediaries for the grant making, and that's less true, I think, on the workforce development side, but it's more true on the small business side. For example, the governor's proposal related to small business relief grants for the impact of ICE is again to use the intermediaries of the CDFIs. And I'm partial to that project, I will confess, based on my past experience, having been one of those intermediaries where, you know, I was situated in Little Falls at the Initiative Foundation, and organizations like that are in community and therefore are equipped to bring some of their expertise to bear, also making sure that the public dollars are responsive to reality on the ground.
And maybe as a follow-up to that, in a later slide, you talk about the listening sessions you conducted and received a number of insights. Are you then acting on those insights, I assume? This is on slide, it's the one that says community collaboration. You can just sort of talk about, you kind of described the insights you received. I'm just wondering about any follow-up on those items.
Mr. Chairman, yes. Those were the examples of requests for simplification, requests for more outreach in greater Minnesota and non-English speaking as well. Also wanted to note, I think we've referred to the Minnesota Association of Workforce Boards, and maybe mm-hmm. Kate, who leads that organization, is here.
Okay. Thank you.
And they are the 16 local workforce development areas that, again, are situated all throughout the state, and they are among our closest partners in this process and entirely locally driven. They have boards that are comprised of local business people, local higher ed, local nonprofits, et cetera, so that it's not just the St. Paul perspective, important as that is, but not just that perspective, determining how the programs get delivered.
One thing that's in my head, Commissioner, you referenced the small businesses. So the report was a review of the department's competitive grant processes in general. I don't know if the economic development side, if that is coming, because it was not specific to workforce development programs. That may have been maybe a misunderstanding at the start of the process, possibly, but just something to be keeping in mind for the final report, is that I think our goal was to just understand the department's competitive grant programs, and it was not specific to workforce development. So at least as I'm looking at the law that we passed, I recall that, and I'm looking at the law of the past, it's not specific to workforce development, so something to consider. Good. I got a couple other things, but I'll go to Representative Greenman. You're not on the list, okay. And Chair Baker, you want to be saved for later, or you want to go now?
I go now, because I want to kind of tail off what you just said.
Yeah, Chair Baker, please.
The community reviewers, again, through my process with the Opioid Advisory Council that I sit on, we deploy a lot of dollars and have used the community reviewers. It's a second set of eyes before it comes to the Opioid Council for final decisions. Kind of similar to what I presented in this committee here a couple weeks ago about the direct appropriations. So what I'm imagining is my community reviewers are the governor's workforce board. They're going to have another set of eyes. They know the state well. They're appointed in that way. So again, what this is it's that same kind of setup. The community reviewers are super important to have that sort of that first set on this process. What I wanted to ask you is that what's important about that process is the conflict of interest statement. And have you had any issues with community reviewers where you found some conflict that you had to either reject them or pull them out? Again, you've been doing this longer than I have been with other areas. And maybe this is a question maybe for Mr. Lang, but have you had some issues with conflict of interest, and has that been something that we should be made aware of?
Commissioner Mr. Yeah. Lang, Commissioner, I'll go to you first.
Mr. Co-Chairs, I mean, I would not say that I'm aware that we've had issues of the system breaking down. I'm certain that we have had issues where a person may have disclosed that, yes, they would have a conflict and therefore, you know, can't be involved in weighing in on this or that. I know when I'm serving on the MJSP board, the Minnesota Job Skills Partnership Board, before every meeting, I have to, I think, even sign a form saying whether I have any particular interest with respect to the grantees that are coming before us that day. And so I don't know that I would, unless there was something egregious, I don't know that something like that with a community reviewer would get to me, but I'm not aware that we've had any major issues. Mike, anything to add there?
Mr. Lang, pardon me. Yeah, Mr. Lang, if you're the...
He shook his head.
No. Oh, he shook his head, no. Okay,
maybe
Chair Baker,
yeah. Chair, yeah.
Thank you. Sorry about that.
And again, thank you. And I just know the reviewer process is important. I know that they're a pretty big part of our end result usually. And I just want to make sure that maybe this conversation allows us all to take another look at, do we have the right questions on the conflict of interest signature pad, if you will? Or, again, I want to make sure that those are dynamics that I think we can't ignore, because those folks that are trying to get money from us without being legitimate are going to find every avenue they can. And I think that's just one little, you know, hole in the bucket that we need to always keep an eye on. I just want to bring that up because, again, I've seen it firsthand, too, with the ORX stuff. So appreciate that. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Baker. Can you go to the overview of the grant lifecycle slide?
Yes.
So a couple questions about this. The second bullet, develop guidelines, processes, and materials. I guess I'm curious about how the request for proposals are developed and whether you evaluate them and change them over time. Commissioner, in our prior conversation noted, I've experienced in Department of Public Safety and Office of Justice programs and know that they're sort of evaluating the RFPs and you kind of find this, you know, the legislature enacts a program with pretty broad principles and then you all put that into an RFP and with much more detail, and then kind of ideally are changing it over time as you're identifying what's working, what's working well, what's not working well. Can you talk about your process for evaluating your RFPs and kind of the decisions that you're making and any changes you make over time in programs? Commissioner.
Mr. Co-Chair, thank you for the question. I would say most of that happens at the program level. It's not common that that we would end up having a conversation involving me about a key change to the program, but that is part of the process where we take into account, okay, how did everybody do in the last round, and was there any confusion? Did we not get good applicants? When I would say there are probably more changes happening in newer programs because it might be that we try something the first time and it just isn't landing. Then things do get a little bit more refined over time. And I would say, too, thinking back to my time as an applicant to programs like this, you didn't necessarily want to see massive changes. Now, look, we have to adapt if the public purpose is not being achieved. But other things equal, as a grantee, as a grant seeker, you don't want to have to relearn a whole new thing every two-year cycle, because then it does get to be pretty onerous, because you know, you're also looking at these philanthropic opportunities and federal opportunities and state opportunities, and you know, moving the goalposts gets a little bit tricky.
Right. I mean, presumably you take that into account when you're deciding whether to change an RFP, and so it might be you make only a small change or no change. I guess I'm just wondering about your process. Maybe this is just, I guess what I'll say is that'd be a question I would add in your key questions, is kind of what is our process for evaluating how well an RFP is working? It may be every year you keep it the same. That makes sense if an RFP's, if a program's been operating for a while, it makes sense the RFP probably wouldn't change. That would be something to consider, it seems to me, as opposed to we do the RFP once. What I hate to have it be is we do the RFP once, and there it is, versus evaluating your process. Thank you. And then also on this slide, just that next bullet, RFPs publicly announced, application period opens. What is your timeline typically when you are issuing RFPs? And the sense that I have is for codified programs, it's maybe earlier than for uncodified programs. You have to wait for the legislature to decide to establish it. Can you just talk about that?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. What I could say, and then again, I'll look to my colleague, what I would say is one principle we have is to try to somewhat stagger the timing when we open the RFPs for a number of reasons. One, with a customer focus, because it might be some of the same organizations that theoretically could apply for more than one. but they don't have all that much capacity, and so having them need to apply for a whole bunch all at once is tough. And then likewise, the demand on our systems, if all the community reviewers have a big crush of them all at once, and then our AFS department, our administrative and financial services, they need to all be processing the grant payments all at once, et cetera. So we do try to space them out over time. In terms of the duration of how long is the application window, I mean, in some cases, we are able to extend it if we didn't get lots of good applications in the door. And I do want to reassure you, too, that there have been times when we just haven't awarded money that we had available because we did not feel good about what we got as far as application quality. But, Mike, anything you could add there in terms of duration of the application window or anything else?
Mr. Lang.
Sure. Thank you, Commissioner. Yes, Mr. Co-Chair. We, in working toward that, it may take 2 to 3 months to get from announcement to award. And some of that will shift depending on the amount of oversight our system is taxed with. Because from reviewing an application to selecting them and then working to build the contract and making sure that all the appropriate language is in there, it does take a fair amount of oversight and extra time between executing a contract and making the announcement.
Okay, thank you. And Commissioner, I might go back to your very good not to be appropriating funds if there are no applicants that which would be good to receive. I guess I'm wondering then about the feedback. Do you at that point look at, okay, is there something we do different with the RFP if we can under the law? Or is there something we go back to the legislature and said, hey, you passed this law, you allocated these funds, turns out there's nobody who can apply for it? Or was it something about our process? Like, is there a feedback process? I don't necessarily need a substantive answer now, but that'd be something I think to incorporate in the report as well, if that makes sense. Because I'll just note, we hear a lot of concerns from organizations. The competitive grant process takes a very long time. Commissioner, you talked about the tension and the balance of we don't want to speed it up and go past very important checks. There is an advantage. I think it's the Youth at Work program we heard about on Tuesday on that program, because it's codified. You all are having RFPs in the winter, and then the legislature appropriates whatever funds it does, and presumably you're then ready to get the funds out more quickly because the process has already happened, if I'm understanding that process correctly. Okay, good, thank you. I think that that's pretty much all that I have. We'll see, members, if you've got anything else. I would encourage members and members of the public that in those key questions on the next step slide, if you are aware of questions that that we would want to have answered, please make sure to provide those to the department and probably to the chairs as well, because this is important for us to do. And again, encouraging you to make sure to include your competitive grant processes across your agency, including economic development. Anything else from members? Chair Baker, anything else from you, sir?
You know, not a question, just a statement, and I appreciate the conversation this morning. This has been a mission, I think, for you and I, Chair Pinto, to really dive in deep about how can we do better at what we are trying to help our communities and help our workforce to get more people into the workforce, to our employers, who are the ones who are required to make this all really come together. I encourage anyone to come to us with some ideas. Again, I've thrown out a few ideas here this year. I know Chair Pinto is very engaged in this direction we want to do in a very bipartisan manner to try to find the best ways. And I just hope that when people are listening to us, you know, the folks that have been in the process before, either with a direct appropriation or competitive grant, we are relooking at how we do this. We're not trying to stop it. We're not trying to end your existence, if you will, because there's a lot of nervous people out there that are looking at this. But in light of where we are today in Minnesota, we have to make sure that we're checking more I's and more T's. And I think that's what we're trying to do today. So if we do our best work in this committee and in a long-term search, I hope, Chair Pinto, that we can have some significant impact about how we do this going forward, whether it's competitive or whether it's direct appropriation. So I hope that these conversations are being heard, and I hope the commissioner and the department are seeing that we really need to get serious about making some changes to this kind of process. And again, just tweaking it. A lot of things are going well, but I think we are saying we've got some things to work on too. So thanks for your time on this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, and Commissioner, to you and to your whole agency, thank you so much for the work on this review of this report and overall as well. So, Commissioner, anything that you want to say in conclusion? Let me give you the opportunity if there is anything.
Mr. Chair, members, thanks very much for the opportunity to talk about this. And I think we share the sentiment that you have, that we should always be engaged in continuous improvement, and we know that there are things that can be improved. At the same time, I would say we're very proud of the process that we run, and we do think that it delivers good results, and we're grateful for the dollars that get appropriated to us. And even as we engage in that continuous improvement and ask what can we do better, because there's always an answer to that, we should be proud of the fact that this legislature and this governor and all the private businesses and all the workers in the state have yielded an unemployment rate that is below the national average, have yielded a labor force participation rate that is like 4 or 5 points higher than the national average. So we do better at getting people off the sidelines than a lot of places, and we want to aim even higher, but still we should also take pride in the things that have gone well.
Well, Commissioner, again, thank you so much. Thanks to all of you, we will have continued conversation about this, I know. So, members, we have a little bit of shifting around in our agenda. We're going to have I'm going to ask Representative Wayne Johnson to head to the front, if you're willing, sir. Have House File 4072 be up, and I'll ask Representative Johnson he will move that bill. This is a bill of Representative Green's. Representative Johnson is the co-author, however. She has had a family emergency, and so grateful to you, Representative Johnson, for stepping in. In addition, building on this, the conversation we've been having, this bill was introduced as a direct appropriation, Representative Johnson, if you're willing to move the A1 amendment to convert the bill to a competitive grant, I'd appreciate that.
Yes, I'd like to move that to, based on our, you know, direction and basically our desire to move to competitive grants, I would like to move that.
Thank you so much. So, members, any discussion to the A1 amendment? And seeing all in favor of approval of the A1 amendment, please say aye. Aye. Any opposed? Okay. Thank you. And again, Representative Johnson, thank you so much for stepping in for Representative Green. I know you're on this bill as well, though, so really it's kind of the two of you are partners. So, Representative Johnson, to your and Representative Green's bill.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. This is a great example of us working together and helping out when the need is there. So, Chair Pinto, Co-Chair Baker, and members, this is a bill to $500,000 in fiscal year 2027 is appropriated to the Workforce Development Fund to the Commissioner of Employment and Economic Development. This really has come around, and I don't know if it's in your community, it's definitely in my community, how local newspapers are fading away. And they're either from people not having succession plans or somebody that can step in or just other reasons, not being able to find employees and not being able to move forward. And it has drastically affected our community, and I think it's drastically affected many communities because that is where community comes together, you know, and even though we have internet and we have ways to get online, still opening up the paper and seeing what the community has. Just recently, a pioneer of our local paper at the time, Cottage Grove, just recently passed away. And I remember him, and he was talking about that paper, and he was talking about his legacy. It was that, you know, people would open up and see what was going on legally, who got in trouble with the police, what community event is happening and stuff like that. So I remember it going all the way back to when I was a kid. That's how we got to see what's going on. So what this House File 4072 creates, the local news talent pipeline program to place emerging and early career journalists and media professionals in Minnesota communities based newsrooms in print, radio, and broadcasting and digital platforms. This proposal is built on a successful program administered by the Minnesota News Media Institute, which has placed nearly 1,000 Minnesota students in newsrooms of all sizes since 2005. It will provide a dual benefit, providing career learning opportunities for young Minnesotans, showing them what a future in local media could look like, and helping to strengthen strengthen and sustain our local news outlets, providing them with workforce assistance. This program will also help enhance opportunities for succession, keeping more local newspapers operating into the new generation. And that's one I touched on already. It's like we just have to have something there when somebody wants to finally walk away. So I have Ms. Chair Pinto, I do have two presenters here that I will let them take over.
Okay, whichever testifier is going to go first, please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony. And welcome to you.
Thank you. Members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to speak on this important bill. I'm Tara Brandl. I am the co-owner and publisher of Above the Fold Publishing in Southwest Minnesota. As a rural Minnesota publisher, I originally co-owned one local community newspaper, and we recently purchased three more local newspapers. All of our newspapers are small weekly newspapers that have deep ties to their community. What makes a community newspaper so important is their role in connecting the community and telling the community's story. We run our newspaper with the agenda that everyone has a story. It is our job to tell it. Whether it is reporting on the city council meeting, covering the basketball game, highlighting a local nonprofit, or telling the unique story of a community member, this is what makes community journalism. One of the hardest parts of owning a local newspaper in rural Minnesota is finding staff to cover everything. Usually there is more happening in our community than we can make it to cover. One way we have overcome this challenge is through an intern. 3 years ago, we hired a summer intern with the help of the Minnesota Newspaper Institute's internship program. This was one of the greatest blessings in the growth of our business. Our intern, Sophie, spent the summer helping us cover events and building relationships with our readers. Working with her has made such a difference that we hired her to continue to work with us during her final year of high school and for the summer before college. After graduation, she chose to attend college in the Czech Republic, but she came back and worked for us this summer. And then most recently worked for us for 3 weeks when she was home on Christmas break. Hiring Sophie through this internship program allowed us to bring more stories to our readers when finding staff is so difficult. The biggest aspect of this was the ability to get someone younger into our business and industry. Funding for positions like this in all media throughout Minnesota, especially greater Minnesota, helps strengthen the future of journalism in all forms. Local journalism is vital for the success of our state on so many levels, and this bill provides a great step in bringing in the next generation of journalists. As a local publisher, I hope that you can see the value it brings to all of your districts and that you move forward in supporting this initiative. Thank you
for being here. Thanks for your work. And to the other testifier, please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Pinto and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Wendy Paulson. As president of the Minnesota Broadcasters Association, I represent 300 local radio and television member stations, as well as stakeholders in the broadcast industry. Minnesota's local newsrooms are committed to serving their communities with trusted, reliable information, accessible free of charge. But like many industries, we face a growing workforce challenge across Minnesota. Broadcast stations are struggling to recruit the next generation of journalists. Students may not be aware of the many different careers that broadcast journalism has to offer. For our members, finding the time and budget to get the word out is a constant challenge. The Local News Talent Pipeline Act is a smart investment in Minnesota's future journalists. It helps create paid internship opportunities and clear career pathways into local newsrooms. We are grateful for Representative Green's leadership on this bill, as well as thanking our Representative Johnson for your co-sponsorship. We are also very proud to support this. This program would allow stations across our state to participate, fund paid internships, ensure students from all backgrounds can explore and pursue careers in journalism, and it helps create a strong pipeline of trained professionals who are ready to step into local newsrooms statewide. Investing in the journalism workforce helps ensure Minnesotans continue to have access to trusted local news and information. Strong local journalism strengthens Minnesota communities. Local reporters cover school boards, city council meetings, elections, local sports, and community issues that directly affect residents. Investing in the next generation of journalists is an investment in informed communities across Minnesota. We respectfully ask for your support of House File 4072. and thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you. Thank you for being here, and thanks to you for your work as well. Anybody else in the, who's in the room here wish to testify on the bill? Not seeing any, we'll close testimony. So members of the committee, comments, questions, anybody else? Representative Lesnikar, we'll go to you. And
thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative, for presenting this bill. I think this is a wonderful idea. I think it's really important. I know in the community I represent, Proctor High School has a fantastic Rails TV broadcasting where students are, you know, broadcasting sports and many other different things. But it goes into local journalism for the papers locally to show the heart of the community, which I think is really, really important. It also exposes them to radio and to television and all the aspects of journalism and broadcasting. And so I think this is a fantastic idea. We do things like this in other career technical education with culinary programs and various other things. So I'm happy to see this get added in the wheelhouse. So thank you for the bill. I think it'll be great for the communities. Thank you to the city of Proctor for, in my community, doing a resolution. It's really important to the communities to have the local flavor of journalism. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Chair Baker, to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, thank you, Rep. Johnson, for bringing this forward to us. I know that you have worked on this. You've worked bipartisanly on a number of bills this is your first session, and you've done a nice job. And this is one of those areas that I've just impressed with your digging in and doing the right things. This is a bill that I can support. Now, maybe my question to you now would be, is this scalable? If we didn't have this much money, can it work with a little less? Because this is a challenging budget year, and we don't have anything yet. I'm just maybe asking either you or your testifiers, will this work if it was not the same amount of what your request is?
Representative Johnson, or to one of the testifiers. Yeah, Ms. Okay, if you can please identify yourself and then proceed.
I'm sorry, Chair and committee members. I'm Lisa Hills. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Newspaper Association and Minnesota News Media Institute.
And to the question,
yes, Chair Baker.
Yeah, just to repeat the question, just like the bill a lot. If we didn't quite have this much, is there something you can use if it was half that amount or 300,000 versus the 500 you're requesting? Is that possible with this program?
And if you can say your name again. Pardon me, Lisa?
Lisa Hills.
Hills, okay, Ms. Hills.
Yes. Thank you, and Chair, Representative. We would be grateful for any amount of funding. There is a huge need, and any amount of funding would make a difference, and so we would appreciate any consideration.
I'd have to believe it is scalable, but Chair Baker, back to you.
I would think it is, yeah, and thanks again. We don't really know what it looks like yet, but again, I just that was one question I really had for the bill. My daughter started with it as an intern with West Central Tribune back in Wilmer. Now, again, she went into mass communications. She's an executive producer now and does very, very well. She loves her hometown stuff. She loves what we do there, and I know this is important to get interns in the door that way. So again, to Representative Johnson's work this session and on bills like this, I'm glad you were able to, you know, pinch hit today for Representative Green that was not able to be here today. So just thank you for that, and I appreciate your work on these things, and thanks for bringing it to my attention as well. So good work on this. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Baker. Yeah, we'll go to Representative Hussein.
Thank you for testifies, for bringing Representative Johnson, for carrying this bill on behalf of our colleagues. I do see a lot of often, you know, a lot of young generation who graduated and still looking for opportunity to internship with pay. So this is a great opportunity that this is a great bill, and I am excited to co-author and support.
Jeff Frazier, to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson, thank you for pinch hitting for Representative Green. Let me say this. I like this because I used to serve on a board that specifically focused on getting young people and community members into the area of media, journalism, television as well. And I look at how our media has been consolidated today and how there's only so many options.
Right.
There's only so many networks, and they really get to shape the narrative. And we lose that very local perspective that is very much important and needed for people to know what's happening in their community. And just giving an opportunity for people to have an opportunity to raise up in these type of in these type of jobs and these type of careers. I think that's very important. So thank you for working in a bipartisan way to get this done. It means a tremendous amount to our young people that are looking to get into this career area. It also means a tremendous amount to society in terms of having that local focus on what's happening in your community, and not just in our communities in our states, but around this country. So I appreciate the work you've done on this.
Yeah, Chair Frazier, I couldn't agree more. And I was thinking to myself that it's as there's been, you know, sometimes we have this lack of shared facts and shared truth sometimes in our society. It's the local, when that local news and the person who lives down the street from you who's reporting on what's happening in your community, there's a real power. And I think we're all recognizing that. So this is terrific. I want to build on Chair Baker's point about the scalability. And just as I'm looking at this, I'm thinking there may be some ways that that you might want to structure the competitive grant program in different ways. We can talk about that. Right now this is set up that the commissioner would do individual grants for internships. You could imagine a situation where there's an organization, and perhaps it's Minnesota News Media Institute, but we want to, again, open up to whomever, which could receive a grant, and then may at that point maybe would provide those paid internships directly. And we can have a conversation about that. But I think that there are ways to structure this, especially if there is some scalability needed. So perhaps we can follow up with one another if the opportunity arises. So I'm not seeing any other questions. Representative Johnson, to your and Representative Green's bill.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. And I'd also like to recognize again Representative Green has been a great partner in this bill and her work on this. She has also recognized how important how local media is. And if you ever watch when you go to a national and they try to come in and cover local, they try to pronounce the town that they're in. And so you can tell right away that they're not from the area. And so it just shows how important, it is very important that you have community connections, whether it's broadcast, newspaper, whatever way, that there's somebody that knows the community that they're in. And if somebody could grew up in the community, then sees an opportunity to go back to their community after they're done with school to cover the community that they've known since they were a kid. That's where you really build trust, and that's where the real connections happen. So thank you for hearing this bill today, and I look forward for your support. So thank you.
Representative Johnson, thank you so much. Thanks to you testifiers and for your work. It really is so important. So we're grateful to you. With that, the chair lays over House File 4072 as amended for possible inclusion in a budget bill. We'll sort of see where all that lands. Members, we're going to jump out of grant mode here just because of some scheduling issues. And Representative Vernig, we're going to ask you to come up. Oh, there you are. I will ask Chair Baker, if you'd be willing to move House File 3691 to bring it before us.
Yes, Mr. Chair, happy to move House File 3691.
Thank you, sir. Representative Vernig, I don't see any amendments, so once you get settled in, please present your bill.
It's the shortest bill, so it'd be sad if it had amendments. Yeah. Before you is House File 3691, a bipartisan bill brought forth by the Association of Minnesota This might be the shortest bill you hear today. It really is just two words. It adds emergency managers to the list of essential job classes. Over the years, I've been able to work with emergency managers in a variety of ways, from the 35W bridge collapse to mass casualty drills at the airport. Emergency managers are an essential component to public safety, and this bill would create consistency across Minnesota jurisdictions, and it would codify long-held standards. It would also help with recruitment, retention, and professional recognition. A core tenet of emergency management is responding to critical situations and emergencies that arise. They are on call 24/7 because exploding manhole covers, train derailments, bus crashes, space weather, tornadoes, floods, and public health emergencies don't just happen between 9 and 5. Emergency managers are the ones coordinating in support of the first responders behind the scenes. The bill aligns the emergency manager's role with public safety and current employment expectations in just two words. Those two words are emergency manager, and it would clarify the status of these essential employees. I do have two testifiers.
Thank you so much. And whichever testifier is going to go first, please identify yourself and proceed.
Okay. Good morning, Mr. Chairs and members of the committee. I'm Erin Hughes. I'm the emergency manager in Stearns County. Thank you for the opportunity to come and talk with you a little bit about the House File 3691 today. I am here to help represent the Association of Minnesota Emergency Managers' voice as well. The work we do isn't theoretical. It is daily, year-round work that really, truly impacts everyone who lives, works, and visits our communities throughout Minnesota. I'd like to take just a couple minutes to highlight some of the reasons why this role should be considered essential. First and foremost, emergency management is critical to life safety. We always come up with these lists of events and that never seem to end with, we're talking about train derailments or aviation emergencies, severe weather. We just experienced a pretty significant blizzard again. We're there for all of these events, supporting our public safety partners, and we really want to work for that critical, timely interagency coordination. Next, emergency management really helps to make sure that continuity of government continues when these events do happen. So we need to take care of the emergency, but we also need to make sure the services we provide at local government continue day to day as well. We operationalize emergency operations centers to be able to allocate resources and provide for interagency coordination. Without the ability to do that, we certainly risk fragmented response with slow and potentially inadequate resources. We are also a unique role that no other discipline covers. We work with law enforcement, fire service, the public health departments, public works, private industry, non-government organizations, and we bring everybody together to make sure that we have the best that's available when we need to respond to the needs of our community. This is continuous work. We don't do it only when something happens. Oftentimes people see us when something happens, but then day to day we're doing that work to develop threat assessments and hazard vulnerability assessments. We're managing grant funds to be able to do preparedness and mitigation work. And we're using that partner engagement with hospitals and schools and local businesses to make sure we're all prepared and ready to respond when that time comes. We're always looking to maintain that state of readiness. Without the essential status, sometimes there's barriers. Being able to get access to critical resources and facilities, being able to have the clear recognition that this work is important and timely and it needs to be considered 365 days a year. We also know that the community needs us to be there, and essential status helps to ensure that we legally and operationally can be. I think last, we want to be aligned with our other essential service providers, those in public safety, the public health community, healthcare, et cetera, so that emergency management is staff supported and operational when it matters most. So in conclusion, Minnesota cannot effectively prepare for, respond to, or recover from emergencies without our emergency managers. Our communities depend on this role every day, often without even realizing it. Classifying emergency managers as essential employees ensures that we can continue to do the job the public expects and needs us to do. Emergency managers are already essential in practice. This bill would recognize that in statute. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thanks for your important work. And then to the other testifier, please identify yourself and proceed.
Yeah, Seth Hansen, Wright County Emergency Management Director, and representing AMEM as well. She pretty much touched on everything, so I'll just regurgitate a couple things. But as emergency managers, our job functions are to integrate with all of our public safety partners, including police, fire, EMS, even FEMA, Minnesota Homeland Security Emergency Management, public health, and so forth. We're on call 24/7, 365, to respond to any and all emergencies or disasters that happen in our jurisdictions, from anything from floods, tornadoes, man-made incidents, nuclear response, anything. Whatever our our first responders, our partners need and help, we are there for them to help assist them, whether that be through coordination to get the job done, logistics to get them the things they need, and help with messaging and warning to the public, just to name a few. Your emergency managers are the ones that are creating your jurisdiction's plans, from response plans, mitigation plan, recovery plans, and even finding grant funds to help fund the programs that need to happen. We put together the exercises beforehand to ensure our public safety partners are prepared to go through things. What we are asking for today doesn't cost the taxpayers a dime. We're asking for a couple of words to be added into the essential employees thing so that we are recognized for our response and to serve with consistency across all jurisdictions. And that's really all I have because she took the rest.
Okay, good. Thank you. Thank you so much. Anybody else wish to testify on the bill? Was here in the room, not seeing anybody, so we'll close testimony. And so comments and questions, Representative Johnson, Pete.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Rep. Brunig, for bringing the bill forward. Had a lot of conversations with my emergency managers up in the northern part of the state there over the last year and a half about different challenges that they're facing and different ways that we can help with that profession. A lot of it was tied to money and how we fund some of these things, but this seems like a simple fix to acknowledge the work that you do. As firefighters and responders, like a lot of the work that goes into the front end, especially for those real major incidents, are done by folks in your offices, as well as everything that happens after the incident. You know, the emergency responders show up during the core of it, but all that work that goes in on the front end and all that work that goes in on the back end really falls on a lot of the emergency managers across our state to make sure that we're ready and able to respond. So if that's not a definition of an essential employee, I don't know.
Sure, that's fine.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Lesnikar.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative, for the bill. I concur with my colleagues here today that this is a common sense bill, having had recent fires in Brimson, northern Minnesota, and then in my career working when we had to evacuate for rail issues in the early 90s, nursing homes, working with emergency departments in St. Louis County and Lake County were always essential. And so I think this makes sense to have emergency managers included in this. I didn't know they weren't, so I'm glad it's a fix that makes sense. Thank you.
Thank you, and Chair Baker, to you.
Yeah. I fully support this, and I think one of my biggest questions is, why haven't you been included up to now? Has there been a change in the name of the position? I mean, I get to work with Ace Bonema. He's our local emergency manager. He sleeps literally with one eye open. And he was there when we had the trail derailment in Raymond, Minnesota here just recently. The wildfires that we've started to have, we've had avian flu, turkey outbreaks. I know how important this is, and I'm fully supportive of this, but can you tell me, why are you asking this now when it, to me, how could it have gotten missed? Is it something that just was an oversight? And I'm not sure who I'm asking it to, but just.
Ms. Hughes? Mr. Hansen?
Whoever.
Thank you for your
Ms.
question.
Ms. Hughes.
I think really what we've seen is over the last, we've had emergency management in the state of Minnesota for decades, starting as civil defense and transitioning into emergency management, some Office of Emergency Services, depending on the community. But really the change that we've seen is the professionalization of this program and these workers. We often have times had people who had multiple hats and roles, and we still do in many areas of the state. But as we've worked, you can now have a degree in emergency management. There's formal training at a bachelor's, master's, and doctorate level. And so this is, I think, maybe some oversight in the past that there may have been opportunity, but really this is coming to the forefront as we continue to really work on the professionalization of the service.
And it looks like Representative Vernig has something to add. Representative Vernig. Or Mr. Hansen, okay. Mr. Hansen.
No, and I think a reason a lot of times this may have gotten missed is before your emergency managers happened to be retired fire chiefs or retired police chiefs or what have you. It was never a singled-in discipline as it is now. So I feel a lot of that might be the reason it had been missed in the past.
Okay. And Representative Vernick, something else you want to add?
Yeah, I actually looked into this because I thought it might be a question that comes up. And Minnesota is uniquely over-prescriptive, and it outlines everybody, where sometimes other states it's more of a job class versus a job title. And when you go through and everybody, like Representative Lesnikar said, what, you're not part of that? What do you mean? So,
yeah.
Chair Baker.
And Representative Vernick, thanks for bringing the bill forward, and thanks for helping us getting it right. This is something I fully support and appreciate you bringing it forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Baker. Yeah, appreciate it as well. Representative Vernick, final comments from you.
Thank you, chairs and committee members. Emergency managers are essential in practice. This bill simply recognizes that.
All right, thank you. The motion had been just to bring the bill before us, but I think it's actually the motion is going to be to send the bill to public safety. We'll have to sort of see exactly what the path is for that, but is that okay with you, Chair Baker? Okay. All right, so the members, Chair Baker is moving that House File 3691 be recommended for referral to the Public Safety, Finance, and Policy Committee. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay. Congratulations, Representative Vernig. Thank you so much to the testifiers. Thank you for your work, your really important work. Grateful to you. Members, our final bill, our bill author is currently presenting it in another committee, and I'm inclined to give her the chance to get here. So we're going to go on recess for just a couple minutes. I think she should be back very, very shortly. We can all pause momentarily. The committee stands in recess.
Which one are you? It is literally not a marathon.
We're sprinting today. We're sprinting today.
Exactly. What?
I'm calling this calling the meeting back to order. Thank you all for that brief pause. We get our bill author here. Hope that things went well in the other committee, and here we are with House File 4613. So, Representative Greenman, you are moving that bill to be brought before us. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I am.
Yeah, and then you have a DE1 amendment, and members, I'll just note that again, as with the other bill, the bill from Representative Green, Representative Johnson, we're taking proposals for direct appropriations and saying, hey, we want to make sure that we are having a competitive process here. And so, Representative Greenman, you're moving the DE1 amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am moving the DE1 amendment, and I will explain more in general, but this is after a conversation. We have been talking about this great idea about how we invest in homegrown events and, with Twin Cities in Motion. And when they came to me about a direct appropriation, I said, how about we think about a competitive grant that will do what we want to do and invest in, but do it in a way that we've been talking about. And that's what the DE1 is. And I can explain more about it when we adopt it.
Okay, well, and hopefully, members, your folks are okay with amending the bill as the author wishes. We'll see if there's any discussion on that. And if not, then all in favor of approval of the DE1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay, that passes. And so, Representative Greenman, to your amended bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what this bill is and what it is fundamentally about is our investment in those homegrown sports and recreation events that are happening annually and are doing things and are interested in growing their economic development, their footprint, growing the size, but also growing their relationship with our communities and our local businesses. I'm going to explain the bill and then finish, before I turn over my testifier, with the origin of how I started thinking about this. But what this bill does is it says we're going to set up a competitive grant program, and it includes eligible projects as projects that would have a significant positive impact on the local economy beyond the effect of just the event occurring in the existing form. That's why it's called a catalyst program. Increase the size or duration of the events, bring in additional participants, either from around the state or bringing people into our state, enhancing the participation of local businesses, or increasing the impact on economic and local development. It also includes, those are the kinds of events that will be eligible, sports and recreation. It also includes the award criteria. And why I think that that's important for this committee is for the last 2 years, both of our chairs and many of us have been talking about what does it look like as a legislature to say our job is to really lay out the criteria and the policy goals, mm-hmm. and then give the discretion to, or the process, I should say, that is also pretty well legislated to the agency to decide who fits those goals. But that means that we really have to think about and put into statute what those goals are, what we are trying to accomplish, what we want to measure. And so in their award criteria, looking at one, scoring based on having a significant impact on the local economy, again, beyond the effect of just it happening on its own, enhancing athletics or recreation in Minnesota, ensuring that we're better connecting these events with local businesses and community and civic life, and improving the long-term viability of these events and its positive impact on the local community. That's the kind of criteria that we're looking for and the investment we're looking for. This, I started thinking about this when Twin Cities in Motion, who runs the marathon and related events, came to me because a lot of that marathon runs right through my district. I've never run the marathon. I'm not a runner. I sort of got out of breath coming from G3 in my last bill.
You're sprinting.
Yes, exactly. It was a sprint. But what I do know is every year on marathon weekend, there I have neighbors all the way down the creek who bring, they set up, they bring coffee, they play music. And I also know, and one of the ways we're having a conversation is that they've started to think about how do we actually both grow that event, bring more people in, make it a one of the, and I will not steal your testimony, how it is growing in terms of national impact, but also in my community, we have a business district. And what would it look like to actually do some of that outreach work to say, after people go to the marathon, they should come and solicit and spend the day, you know, having a morning coffee or drink, if you are so inclined, at those local businesses. And that takes work and that takes resources that many of these events, that's not their original mission, right? The mission is to run to set up a marathon. But this is a catalyst that is both good for the event and the long-term sustainability of the event, but also good for our communities. And so I know that, I can think of a few in my district alone, the marathon, the pond hockey championships, but I see that Representative Schultz is dressed up for the state tournament today, which also, if they have a plan, we have a lot of good, and I feel like you guys should talk about it, but I can imagine in every district around the state, people having sports and recreation events that are annual, that are homegrown, and that are about what they bring to the community, not just sort of, this is not the event. We can talk about in different spaces of trying to attract things that are one and done. This is about homegrown catalysts. So with that, that's where this came from, and it came from a lot of conversations. I think these are good investments, but I also think there's lots of ways we should be doing this, and so this is why it's a competitive grant program.
Thank you so much, Representative Greenman. Thanks for your work on this. To your testifier, Mr. Orton, please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, good morning, Co-Chair Pinto, Co-Chair Baker, and members of the committee. I'm Dean Orton. I am the president for Twin Cities in Motion. We are the proud nonprofit stewards of the Twin Cities Marathon Weekend, Minnesota's largest annual mass participation sport event. It registers now more over 30,000 participants from all 50 states, from over 30 countries, and is just amazingly supported by over 300,000 cheering fans on course. And I'm here today to express our support for House File 4613. While the bill looks a bit different, given the amendment that was adopted, we're glad to have the conversation about how with the lawmakers about how leading events like Marathon Weekend can work to increase the economic impact in our state. The Marathon Weekend has climbed around to the 28th in the nation, already a testament to Minnesota's strength and really over 45 years of pure community passion to build a world-class event. And with our move-up plan that we are proposing, we are requesting state support for the first time in our history because we know Minnesota has what it takes to be a top 15 national experience. We know that because we can build on the exceptional strengths that our outdoor culture has, the hospitality and transportation infrastructure in Minnesota, the corporate engagement, the small business, the major employers as well, and just the community participation that sets the bar in this industry. Together, it's a finish line we really feel strongly we can cross. I'll briefly just give some examples of how we have a three-tiered proposal of how the funds would be used to get this type of growth. First would be in expanding the ability to handle more people in the form of public infrastructure and public safety capacity. Again, we'd be looking at about a 30% increase over a three-year period of about 10,000 participants, working to have that 300,000 spectator go closer to 400,000 on course. So making sure we're ready to do that safely and have that extra capacity supported is the first pillar. Second pillar is what really drives that growth. We are looking at, I think, some of the most exciting initiatives in our history that extend the footprint in two ways. One, extending for the first time to have a Greater Minnesota qualifier experience in the spring. Take the power and energy behind this event, bring that to Greater Minnesota. Second, we're looking at extending the footprint itself by adding additional distances and looking at adding additional modalities, biking. It could be a biathlon experience, which adds extreme interest and, again, more national attention and interest for participation. And so those are the things that we'd look to enhance in terms of the experience and footprint, including additional work that we feel we are falling behind in establishing the professional fields of the experience. So those are the areas of kind of that second pillar. The third pillar that works together kind of hand in glove is the idea of what we can do to improve our marketing and storytelling, not just pure advertising dollars for pure advertising dollars, but really create something unique where we would create a challenge. We'd bind together with other races in other states to create a race challenge and market a new product where they really is. We are one of five other amazing races that you have to participate. Again, really working to invest national and international promotion, all designed to significantly grow out-of-state participation, an important part of our growth. So by teaming up, we can elevate the Minnesota already is kind of what Minnesota is already doing exceptionally well, bringing more growth and growing the especially in the idea of where there is endurance sports growth in the future, and how do we bring that to our home state of Minnesota. We believe this is also well-timed for that reason, because over the next five-plus years, about $11 billion in growth is going to happen in this endurance sports space. We want to bring as much of that to Minnesota as we can capture. So we've to at least get a baseline of where we stand even now in that market. We did work with the University of Minnesota Tourism Center to conduct our first full economic impact study this fall. Pleased to share for the first time, we found out what the marathon generated. Pleased to share that it generated estimated $48 million in economic impact for the state. We're proud of that, but that's not where we want to rest. This plan would put us, based on their work and these levels of attendance and growth, to be a top 15, we'd be over $60 million of annual, every year kind of impact. So that would be the work at hand in terms of measuring success.
I'll maybe ask you to wrap up if you can.
Sure.
Thank you.
Just lastly, we know you made other investments, and we'd really appreciate the idea that investing in Minnesota, we're here every year, we're embedded. Again, appreciate the opportunity for us in this grant program. Thank you to Representative Green for the work with us. Thank you to the committee members. and hope that you will be favorable towards House File 4613.
Thank you so much. Thanks for your testimony. Anybody else in the public wish to testify on the bill? Not seeing any, we'll close testimony. Representative Schultz, to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Greenman, and in part because you found a solution to a challenge that I found when I was speaking with the Twin Cities Marathon, where this shouldn't be just looking at one particular event. As you know, there's countless of them across the state, and the simple, you know, response to any request from any one of those sporting events is that, well, if we choose you, then we're going to have to choose everybody at some point in time in the future. And so to have a competitive grant around this is a good idea, but we are ultimately at some point in time going to be limited by the amount of money that there is for this sort of thing. I think largely Minnesotans would believe that we want to showcase our outdoor heritage and culture and the way that we love you know, all of the sporting events that were referenced by your testifier. And we just have to be conscious of the fact that we will not be able to please everyone with the state's budget. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Schultz. Before I go to Chair Baker, I'll note, I think that's exactly the point, that the funds are limited. And so what we want to do as legislators is do the thing that we do best, which is to choose among policy goals and then have the agency then allocate the limited funds to meet those goals. So I really appreciate, Representative Greenman, the way you've laid this out. I think that when we don't do that in this way and we just identify individual organizations, that's when we start making decisions maybe based not on those best policy goals.
So I don't want to be misconstrued as saying that I oppose the direction that Representative
is
going.
No, absolutely.
And I'm just trying to, say that going this competitive grants route is a good thing, and that what we have been talking about this session has been super productive for the future. Thank you so much.
And Representative Schultz, not meaning to imply that that at all. I guess I'm kind of, as maybe part of the broader conversations beyond just this particular proposal, kind of using this as an example of those broader points. That was all. Chair Baker, to you. We'll certainly end with Representative Greenman, but Chair Baker, to you.
Yeah, thanks for the bill. I appreciate this. And again, Mr. Horton, thank you for bringing this. I've had a really good conversation with you. I appreciate the thoughts about the statewide footprint. I think that really resonates with me. I know that in my vision about this, these kinds of events like this, whether it's the Twin City Marathon, and you guys have done such an amazing, good job over the years to build it to what it is today, and never having any state support before, so congratulations to that. And we have supported other certain events before, and others are requesting us at the same time right now that we just aren't in the right place. Minnesota's communities around Minnesota already do a lot for their local events. What I've always dreamt about is still having a sort of a fund, if you will, with taxes that are currently being paid, because I don't want to raise taxes, but we're raising a lot of taxes in certain communities, and I'll call them our regional cities and our larger areas, that collect, like, say, lodging taxes or hospitality taxes. And I think that what we have to realize is that those kinds of events and those regional centers that actually, I think, do pretty darn well, bringing in those dollars, we could maybe look at that through our Explore Minnesota friends and how we could maybe use that kind of a carve-out. Again, I don't want to raise taxes, but I think that there are taxes enough coming in to those current types of events to create more need for more Super Bowls, more larger events like the Twin City Marathon wants to do, PGA Tour, the Ryder Cup, all those things that are wanting to come and have come. We need to have a better system so that we have a better pipeline to funnel these events, because what you want to do is make it a top-class event, better than it is today, and I fully support that. And I think, just in closing, as you sprinted in the door here today, Rep. Greenman, I think we should have and I love the endurance sport thing. I think the endurance sport that we live in here in the legislature, we ought to have an endurance relay for legislators during the event, and we could just all run about three blocks, and we hand it off to somebody else, and you go on. But, I mean,
sounds like a project for the civility,
we're in the endurance world here,
Mr. Chair.
But I appreciate this. Thanks for bringing the bill.
Thank you, Chair Baker. Before I send it to you, Representative Greenman, I'll note again, this is an economic development competitive grant program, so the discussions we've been having throughout the session are not just limited to workforce development. It's across the agency, across agencies, really. But I'm so grateful to you, Representative Greenman, for thinking this through, and to Ms. Shalene in House Research, who's been helping us along the way, and I see her handiwork in this amendment, and she's been really helping Chair Baker and me to think this through. But just recognizing that we, again, our job is to identify policy goals and then give agencies funding and then evaluate how they meet those goals. This is just a terrific example of that, and we can really see the clarity in it. Representative Greenman, to you to close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chair Baker, I love your idea of a legislative relay. I think it's probably the best way to lose votes on this bill. but I would do it with you. I really appreciate this conversation. And I think, you know, as I was thinking about this, I was thinking about, and I think our job here is, what is the purpose? What is the intervention we are trying to have with government money? And right. And I think in this case for economic development, what we are talking about is not, and this is why in the bill language, right, it is a catalyst. It is about doing something that wouldn't otherwise happen if we didn't invest. And also it's about doing something that is going to inure to the benefit of our communities. And whether that is a small business, a small neighborhood like mine that sort of has a connection with this event and a big weekend that starts that wouldn't have otherwise started because nobody was there to do the work, or it is moving from into the top 15 of national events and then staying here. And that piece was really important. But I think that this conversation and Representative Schultz, if you have other thoughts and ideas, mm-hmm. to me, the muscle memory that we're building is how do we think about those funding sources and those grants in a way that we get much more specific about how we want those choices to be made, not just because they're in my district or your district or we have them in negotiations, and not just because we've given a very general template to DEED and they've, you know, we're going to let them decide what they want to decide. I think the middle ground here is how do we create and really spend our time thinking about what are those goals for government intervention, what are those goals for those resources, and how do we want those priorities to be decided? I certainly said my priorities are that they are homegrown, and I know that there's other competitive grants we could do, but things that are going to be here for the long haul. I also thought it was really important that it is that catalyst piece of we're looking for events that are standing on solid ground, and we can add value to that. So those are just, again, as I was talking to the Twin Cities Emotions folks, and we have been talking, but I think that this is a great discussion, and it is a great discussion about how we could be investing. And I think with that, Mr. Chair, I was going to make a getting it to the finish line joke, but I didn't have one.
Probably, probably just as well. Yeah,
I was going to take it to the finish line.
this is a great model. This is a great model for how to think this through, Representative Greenman, and one that seems to have a lot of bipartisan support. And I'd certainly encourage others who are watching to please think in this manner as well, because I think you're getting a lot of nods I was seeing all around the table. So thank you so much. With that, House File 4613 as amended is laid over for possible inclusion in a budget bill. Chair Baker, I suspect you don't have a preview for what might happen after the break.
Really
what do you
don't.
Want to say, Chair Baker?
Mr. Chair, we don't really have that. We're still working on a plan. I think I'll have the gavel on the 7th of April when mm-hmm. we come back from Easter Passover break. So, again, just want to say thanks, everybody, for getting us to the midway point, and I look forward to the last 6 weeks when we come back.
Thank you, Chair Baker, as well. Yeah, please continue to be in touch with us. And not seeing anything else with that, the meeting is adjourned.